Welcome to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
My name is Jill.
And my name is Michael.
Catch us every other Wednesday talking about books, publishing, indie bookstores, chatting with authors, and so much more.
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Book It Pod for more Book It content.
Want to read something you heard about on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/BookItPod. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Jill.
How's it going?
I am doing fine. How are you?
I am really good. I loved the Instagram story of Taryn, your pup, curling up in a ball, like making his little circle before he plopped down in his like blanket nest.
Yes. We took a vote and it's been decided that my dog Taryn is the cutest dog that's ever existed in the world ever.
Yeah.
And so he does this adorable little turn into like a cozy spot that I literally always miss, and I try to get on camera, and he just was being cute generally, and so I grabbed a video of him and he did it and he plopped his little head down, and I have actually received a lot of feedback from that little video.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I have also gotten feedback about my children recently, but it was not good.
Oh my God. Drag them.
So last night was Meet the Teacher night at the middle school.
Big night.
You walk your kids' schedule, you meet their teachers, and it's really just a very informal, like, put a face to a name. It's not a parent-teacher conference.
Sure. Right.
So, you know, we start off, everything's going well. We visit a few of the rooms. We stop in a teacher's room and introduce ourselves, say, hey, we're Pip and Truman's parents. Oh, hi, blah, blah, blah. I guess you heard about what happened on Friday. No, I did not hear about what happened on Friday. I was like, what happened on Friday? Like, please tell me it's good.
Yeah.
So teacher says, well, I noticed child has been having a hard time getting to this class on time. And I know they come from the other side of the building when they're at orchestra. So at first I wasn't really concerned about it, but after 2 or 3 days, I just did a check-in and was like, hey, how can I help you get here on time? And I said, oh, that's unusual. They're both in orchestra. They're both coming, but only this child
one
is late.
Yeah.
And she gives that smile like, yeah, you've caught on. And I was like, okay. Then what happened? And she was like, well, child started telling me the story about how the eighth graders were like blocking their exit from the music wing and they couldn't get out and it was holding them up and there were 2 or 3 kids and it was happening every day. And she was like, so I immediately got concerned because, you know, we're just have a zero tolerance on bullies.
Absolutely.
We're going to get right on it. And I was like, oh my goodness. Like, I'm instantly concerned, you know, like, oh my gosh. I said, well, and I'm sure you're not allowed to tell me who the other kids are, but I can find out. And she said, yeah, whatever. And she goes, well, hold up. Let me just tell you the rest of the story. And I'm like, okay. What more is there? And she said, well, I reached out to the assistant principal for the 8th grade. And I said, hey, this is going on. He took it really seriously. He calls child and the 2 other kids who were also being late into the assistant principal's office to get more information. Like, hey, what's going on? We're going to advocate on your behalf. Like, this is not okay. Where it turns out that perhaps the story had been, let's say, embellished.
Sure.
And that there really wasn't a roaming gang of 8th graders targeting lowly 7th grade orchestra students.
Uh-huh.
It was more like the hallway was clogged and there were 8th graders amongst the people in the hallway. And we didn't want to be in trouble for being late to class.
So we blamed the 8th graders.
Yeah. Liar, liar, pants on fire.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, thank you for making me aware.
Yeah.
We will talk about it at home.
Yeah.
And teacher's like, that would be really outstanding. I get home. This child just happens to open the door right when we walk up.
No idea what they were getting into.
I just started cackling. And the child is like, what? And I was like, you tell me what.
I do not miss these days.
And the child was like, what? I don't know. And I was like, sounds like Friday was exciting. Eyeballs like this big. I don't know what you're talking about. Smirky lie face. It's like, I think you do. And then I look over child to the other child who's walked over. And I said, interesting that you didn't mention this since you witnessed it. And that child just turned around and left.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Yes.
Not my circus, not my monkeys.
Yeah. Switzerland.
And can I just tell you, this child was so chill about having basically lied to the assistant principal. This child was like, well, I'm not in trouble. And I was like, I get that you panicked in the moment and I don't even know how to describe this. They lied. I'm like, I know you panicked in the moment and this is what you said because you didn't want to be in trouble. But, and you, it sounds like, did not receive a specific punishment at school. I'm not done yet.
There you go. Yeah. Snaps for Jill.
But you got caught lying by the assistant principal and your teacher on the
because they were trying to do the right thing.
Day of school. It's not a good look for you, okay? That's all I'm saying.
I think I know which child this is.
Yeah.
Do I? Do you think I do?
Probably.
Just from other conversations we've had about the new teen years.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a...
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's a hand signal for the child. Yeah. Yeah, I was talking about it on my family group chat last night, and I didn't identify that it was the middle school. So my sister was taking a guess, and I said, it's not the child you think it is. And then Mark started laughing, and he goes, is the child that people think it might be the one I think it is? And I said, yeah. And, and then I said, it's not even the second child you think it might be. Yeah. Anyway.
Wow. I really super am endlessly glad to not be 13 anymore.
For sure. And I was just thinking of your video of Taryn and just remembering when they were little and curled up in cute places and missing those days and really just enjoying cute pet videos.
That's all we can do right now as we navigate puberty.
Do you feel like you're getting secondhand puberty PTSD from this?
Yes. As you're talking about it, I have a very specific memory of just super lying. And my mom, we were upstairs and she went, Mr. Michael. And I was like, oh
no.
That is not casual.
Yes.
And I am in trouble.
The whole thing stressed me out. I was like, you were in the assistant principal's office?
So are they in trouble at home now?
Yeah.
What happens? It happens.
Yeah. I mean, not five alarm trouble, but this is not cool and we're going to, that's not how we roll. All right. I am so excited for this episode.
You do.
Michael and I got to talk with the author of our fourth book club pick, The Gunkle. And when we say we fell in love, we mean texting each other in all caps, stalking him on Instagram, loved this book. If he gets a restraining order, I will understand.
If he already has a restraining order, I would understand. He's not getting it.
Absolutely. So as you know by now, our book club pick was Stephen Rowley's The Gunkle. Let's talk about what it was about this book that made both of us connect to it. And in this way that we immediately wanted to talk with each other and other people about it.
Yeah, it was a really slow, steady obsession for me.
Yeah.
I started seeing it on social, but in a way that usually I see a book, especially with someone who has a following as large as Stephen Rowley, in the arc period. When the advanced reader copies are going out. And I didn't see this until it was a hardcover coming out in a couple weeks book.
Same.
And I was like, this looks really cute. Visually, it looks really cute.
Yeah.
I am seeing all of these blurbs suddenly that are glowing.
Yeah, just raving. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I just knew I definitely wanted to read it. You started reading it before I did, and were really, in the best way, kind of cagey about why you were loving it, but you were letting me know that you were loving it. I think because you were like putting it into the universe, like, fucking read this, Michael. Like, I'm not going to tell you anything other than that I love it.
Well, and I think when I finished it, I said to you, is it okay if I reach out?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I don't know whether they, you know, Stephen would say yes, but I just love this so much. I want to talk to him. And
yes.
I love it. You're always like, yes, do that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course. Like, why not?
The 2 times that it's happened.
Yeah. Well, but that's the thing. I love that we have set that up, though. Like,
yeah.
From the very beginning, we were like, should I? Yes. Because the worst that's going to happen is they say no, but they're definitely going to say no if we don't ask. So then I started reading it and was one of those things where I was actively sad to eventually have to be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the experience of reading this book. I loved the conversation we had about it in our book club chat. And I loved getting to talk to Stephen about it.
Yes, I agree with all of that. And for me, the book was, it was good and it lived up to all the blurbs I had seen. And I picked it up because, I mean, quite honestly, it just looked fun. And we were recording an episode about chill books. And I was like, I just want to read this book. It looks, it looks chill. But then it changed, or I changed in how I felt about it because it surprised me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when books go differently than I expect or just kind of hit me in a different way than I'm anticipating, all of a sudden I want to have a conversation about it and I want to talk more about it. And so for me, this book was, it was funny, it was endearing, it was amazing, but it also just generated in me like, I want to know more about the author, I want to know more about the book, and I want to talk to other people who've read it.
Yeah, and spoiler alert, we did all of that.
Well, let's get into it then. Here is our interview with the Gunkle author, Stephen Rowley. Michael and I are just beyond excited today to be joined by author Stephen Rowley. He has written The Editor and the national bestseller Lily and the Octopus. His newest book is The Gunkle. That's what we'll be talking about today. He has worked as a freelance writer, a newspaper columnist, a screenwriter. He's originally from Portland, Maine, and a graduate of Emerson College. But just like the main character in our book, he currently lives in Palm Springs. Welcome, Stephen.
Jill, Michael, thank you for having me.
We could not be more excited. Could you just really briefly give us and our listeners a synopsis of The Gunkle?
Sure. So The Gunkle is about retired television star Patrick O'Hara, who is living kind of a reclusive life in the desert in Palm Springs when he is tasked with taking in his niece Maisie and nephew Grant, ages 9 and 6, for the summer after the death of their mother. And it sort of brings about a season of healing for all three of them.
You do such an amazing job of capturing the experience of hanging out with kind of the beloved fun uncle. Was this story inspired by your experience? Are you the fun uncle?
that's the first question. Well, I guess we should maybe even backtrack one step further in case anyone's not familiar with the term gunkle.
Right.
It's become very, you know, sort of popular slang in the past 5 or 10 years for gay uncle. And more than that, it has sort of that connotation, Jill, as you say, of that being like the fun, larger than life, kind of anti-mamish, character that might exist in a child's life. And I'm not sure why that is exactly, other than, maybe a gay uncle might be more likely to live in a big city and only fly in at holidays or be able to lavish expensive gifts, you know, with kids I am the uncle to 5. They don't quite have my life figured out. They know I live far away on the opposite coast than they do. And I have a swimming pool and I don't quite go to an office like normal, adults that they see. So yeah, I guess, you know, in some ways that was certainly a jumping off point. And, you know, specifically my brother brought his 2 boys out. They were ages 3 and 5 at the time to visit me. And, he is an attorney on the, on the East Coast. And after less than a day here, he was called back into court and had to quickly sort of leave and left me with his two boys, ages 3 and 5, for what was supposed to be a family, you know, trip together for a week. And so I felt like the supporting or understudy being sort of cast in the lead role all of a sudden.
That's trial by fire, man.
Right.
It really was. And listen, I had help that week, but even then, you know, you sort of realize like, oh, these kids were excited to spend the week with their dad as much as they were for me. Cause you know, he works a lot and, you know, who doesn't love a family vacation? So there was a lot of tap dancing. I would say literal, maybe figurative tap dancing, although maybe a little literal from me, like, you know, trying to entertain them and distract them from the disappointment. So, And I posted a lot of this about that week on Instagram. So if you scroll back far enough, you might be able to see the inspiration for the book was in that week. And my editor, the great Sally Kim at Putnam, sort of saw me flailing a little bit that week. And I think she was the one who said, you know, there might be something to write about here.
I feel like kids are hard to write. They so easily skew too old or too young, and nailing their interest and their speech patterns can be really difficult. And I'm thinking in particular of the part of the book where Grant discovers Patrick's toilet. It's so funny. Like, I snorted out loud and the people around me looked at me like I was crazy. And all the questions, like, I feel pummeled by questions by the end of the day. And so many of them felt so authentic. Can you share a bit about how Grant and Maisie came to you? Did you find them challenging to develop or write?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. B, I do want to mention the toilet or the washlet, as you know, Patrick says he has. He does have this sort of $20,000 Japanese washlet in his house, which the kids don't quite know how to use, and humor ensues. And what an interesting thing as a writer, somebody, you know, because, you know, that's the next question. One, people want to know, are you the gunkle? And two, they want to know, do you have this toilet? And no, I do not. research. But, you know, like,
before we started this call, I said to Michael, I'm not going to ask him if he has the toilet, but I really want to know.
But, you know, like, here's the thing about being an author, you know, you do all this research and then suddenly, you know, the internet thinks I'm a toilet fetishist or something, because all of my suggested ads are for very expensive porcelain devices. So I don't know how thriller writers do it, you know, like, you know, how do you dissolve a body or something? Like, I don't know, like, what happens when all your searches are like that? I really don't know. It would be the government knocking on my door instead of Amazon saying, hey, do you want to buy this appliance? No. But the kids themselves, you know, I don't have kids. I don't have kids of my own. And so that means a lot to me for you to say that, because, you know, I worked very hard on getting them right. As I said, I do have these 5 nieces and nephews in my life, and I'm very moved by how the sort of depth of those relationships and how meaningful they are to me. So it started there. You know, we were once all children ourselves. So you sort of access that part of you, that sort of child inside of you still, and then your memories of childhood and you know, the things you observe. I'm always very aware when I go home to visit, and, you know, these kids like pepper me with questions like nonstop. And I'm like, you know what? I am just having a glass of wine with your mother, my sister, who I flew all the way across the country to see. Why don't we save the question and answer for a second glass?
Yes.
Let me ease into this. But, you know, I love these kids, and you know, it was so fun to write, you know, just, but overall that balance of humor and true emotion was the biggest challenge in the book, sort of getting that just right. And the children sort of illustrate that challenge the most, because they're grieving a pretty difficult loss. Right. But they're still kids. And so finding that balance with them was a real challenge. You know, to the extent that you think it worked, I'm grateful.
I love your dialogue. I think it's so witty and fresh and so unique to each character. And I struggle a lot with dialogue. I think, honestly, dialogue is probably the most difficult thing to get right in a lot of the writing process. And I just want to know, whose literal voice came to you first?
Yeah. I think, you know, I heard Grant so clearly. And so Grant has a little bit of a lisp, and he speaks with that lisp. And then, and that's always something you want to be conscious of? Because I was like, first I was like, oh, this will be a brilliant way that I can avoid dialogue tags. I don't have to constantly put he said or she said between Maisie and Grant, because if I give him this little lisp, you'll always know it's Grant speaking. But you want to do it in a way that seems authentic, and you don't want to hammer it too hard, because you don't really want to write a sentence that's too difficult for a reader to read, or they would stumble, you know, over the words. You kind of want to suggest it and let the reader fill in the rest. But that voice was so clear to me. But Patrick, you know, the Gunkle himself, you know, we're not that far afield, I don't think. I think he's probably the closest character to myself that I've ever written, although he's a little sadder than I am, because he's been through, you know, he's been through a lot too, his own losses. But that's, you know, his sort of banter and wit is probably close to who I am in real life. But dialogue is always challenging for writers. And I don't know what that is. All we do is talk all day, every day. Right. We talk to other people. We listen to people talk to us. And yet suddenly when it comes time to write it, for many writers, you know, it can come off feeling very stilted. And so I think it is just, you know, keeping that ear. I narrated the audiobook for the first time. I've never done that before. And I will tell you that reading the book out loud, reading my manuscript out loud, will always be part of my process now. And it's so helpful in terms of the dialogue. Speak it out loud. If you're a writer and you know, you're just looking at your manuscript, or you're stumbling with dialogue, read it out loud, because that's that'll give you a whole new perspective on it.
I did this book on audio and absolutely loved it. You did such a good job of capturing kind of the highs and lows and bringing to life both the adults and the kids. Can you share with us a little bit about the recording experience?
Yeah, well, first of all, I had to audition. they weren't just going to hand the keys to the kingdom over to me. I don't know where, you know, maybe some pandemic fueled hysteria where I was like, you know what? I think I'd be good at this, you know, and the publisher was like, you may have been locked in your own home for too long and
you were
losing a grip on reality. But, I wanted to try it, and I had my agent sort of approach them about it. And first of all, I want to say I've been so blessed in that the actor Michael Urie has done both of my previous audiobooks, and I released a short story on audio on Audible, which Neil Patrick Harris narrated around the first of the year earlier. So I've worked with great actors. And so first of all, you know, when I said, you know, I was telling a friend, I'm thinking of doing the audiobook. He was like, you're going to put actors out of work during a pandemic. And I was like, oh no, please don't get mad at me. So I hope they forgive me, but I thought, you know, I was really wanted to try this. The interesting thing when you write a novel, particularly something long form, is it lives in your head in a very specific way, and it's yours and yours alone for a very long time. And when someone else records it, you don't have, you know, control over really how they, if they go up at the end of a sentence, but in my head I go down, or you know, all kinds of things. And by the way, this is their job. They should be interpreting the text. You know, that's what an actor does. And they can probably bring things to it that I wouldn't have thought of. But, you know, with this story, I just sort of wanted the opportunity to present it to readers how I heard it. And and I had a lot of fun. They rented publisher rented me a recording studio here in Palm Springs. I went for a week, Monday through Friday, 8-hour days of talking in a recording studio. It was a really fascinating experience, and I loved doing it. I don't know that I'll do it again. I think it might be project specific, but as I say, reading my work out loud will always be part of my writing process from here moving forward, because I learned so much.
I feel like I'm having a slightly dissociative episode right now after listening to, you know, you talk to me and read me your book for 10 hours. And now we're talking and you're talking back to me.
Right. I get working a little lisp from time to time.
Yeah, there you go.
Sure.
Just to bring Grant to life as well. Yeah. But I love that you say that, by the way. By reading Grant, you know, it's just sort of same as writing him too. You want to suggest just enough that, you know, it comes through, but doesn't make him, you know, doesn't make the listener stop and say, oh, this is too much. This is too annoying to listen to, or this is, you know, getting in the way of the story.
Yeah,
absolutely. Michael and I are both garbage people who are obsessed with book covers.
Yeah,
exclusively.
It doesn't matter who we talk to or what book we're talking about. One or the other of us is just like, and the cover.
Right.
The Gunkle is so eye-catching. I just felt like it immediately put a smile on my face. And this book just screams that it's going to be fun and whimsical. Did you get to be involved in the cover design at all?
Yeah, cover design can always be a very fraught process for authors, you know, because we invest so much of our emotional selves in the story. And, you know, either we have an image in mind, or we have an emotional thing that we want the cover to convey. And contractually, authors, you know, for many publishers have what's, or at least I do, something called meaningful consultation. But try defining that in a court of law, you know, that totally doesn't mean anything. It means that they usually ask, do you have any ideas for the cover? And in this case, you know, I was very inspired by this kind of animation that I associate with sort of mid-century 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
There's an artist out here in Palm Springs named Shag who does a lot of artwork in this style. I sent some of his images as inspiration. There's a wonderful then designer at Putnam, Tal Goretzky, and he just ran with that and really did a remarkable job. And I couldn't love it more. I really, yeah, truly love it. If you follow me on Instagram, you'll see I posted someone had just given me they made me a pool towel with the cover on it. And it's so amazing. Like when you see it big like that, I'm like, oh my God, I don't even want to use this as a towel. I kind of want to hang it on my wall. It's like a tapestry. It's so great. So I could not be more pleased with this. It does. And hopefully the book delivers on what the cover promises, which is that sort of sunniness and fun and whimsy. But the book also is still a story about grief. And right, there are some darker and more serious moments too. But I do think the cover, you know, so much that sort of Patrick is an anti-mame type of character, you know, to borrow a phrase from another sort of magical caregiver in a way, the cover is a bit of a spoonful of sugar to help the, you know, to help the sort of medicine of the rest of the story go down. And, you know, there was a lot of conversation about, is this, you know, promising something that the book isn't? But I think the book is all those things. It just has the added depth, hopefully, of also some introspective, you know, an introspective look at grief.
I have noticed a lot of people on Bookstagram really specifically interacting with the Gunkle and the book cover. I think you reshared someone did a like ice cream that was the same colors as the cover.
Yeah.
And it's just so cool. I haven't seen this much activity around a book in a while. And I'm just wondering if you want to, we talked a little bit about this before we started recording, the impact of Bookstagram and sort of like the social media aspect of this book having come out.
Yeah, I have been so blessed with this book in that it really has captured the imagination of Bookstagram in a way that I can't keep up with the love. And I can't tell you what it means to an author to have a book so embraced by readers. Like this one seems almost universally beloved. And I can, you know, feel good about the story that I created, but I know that it's much more than that. It's a combination of the cover has really sparked something. The fact that it's coming out at the beginning of summer, the fact that, you know, and it's such a ray of sunshine, the fact that it's a story about, you know, a character who's been self-isolating for a long time and is finding his way back into the light, just as, you know, we were, you know, it's a little darker today, but you know, when this book came out around Memorial Day, it was, you know, an immediate post-vaccine world where we were all excited about summer again and coming out of our shells a little bit. So there's, you know, there's all sorts of lightning in a bottle kind of things that sort of came together, I think, that really worked to the book's benefit. But yeah, I cannot tell you like what it feels like. Well, first of all, just the idea of Bookstagram itself, it's so truly wonderful that readers just come together just out of a pure love of books, and they read and they rate and they review, and then they curate these incredible images, and no one's getting paid for this. This is just for the passion of sharing books that you love. What I love about it too is it's so organic, right? There's no ad that I could buy or there's no, you know, there's no amount of free books that the publisher could give away that would sort of create, foster the kind of response that this book has had. It has to be organic, and it comes from the bottom up sometimes instead of the top down. And it's really sort of reader fueled, this passion. And that's why I love it, because it's so pure. It's so, you know, kind of beautiful. And I can't tell you what it means to, you know, to have a story that you created. And then, as you say, Michael, there was someone who matched their ice cream cone flavors to this sort of sherbet that was, you know, had all the beautiful colors of the cover. Someone else had their nails painted to replicate the cover. Someone else put it, you know, the book on a canvas and then painted out the image so that it, you know, it just expanded the world of the cover. And like the idea of people having artistic expressions based on an art, you know, an original artwork that you create. It's so lovely. It's so inspiring. And I'm so grateful.
That's just amazing. I'm trying to imagine
the feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Bookstagram community is really amazing, and they have been so kind, to Michael and I as well. Yeah. When we started this project, it's just been overwhelming. I kind of want to change gears a little bit. We talked a bit earlier about, you know, the Gunkle being really funny, and it is. There were several moments where I would, you know, snort or laugh out loud and everyone turns and looks at me, but it also handles grief really thoughtfully and authentically. And I was blown away by the balance of kind of the humor and the poignancy. And I teared up, you know, both as Patrick and the kids moved through their grief journey. And they were hopeful tears and tears of genuine empathy. And I'm just curious, did you set out to strike that balance? Was it a challenging process?
Well, yeah, it was definitely a challenging process. I think I viewed this more of an anti-MAME story when I first started out, in that I was setting out to write sort of a light comedic novel, you know, but Mame sent her orphan nephew off to boarding school, and it sort of sidestepped that whole issue of grief. Early on in the writing process, and I think this was the summer of 2018, I lost one of my very best friends in the world to breast cancer, and she left behind a 6-year-old son, which was devastating. And it got me thinking about grief in children in a very different way, a very much more serious way. And I didn't want to sidestep that anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what's sort of wonderful about the writing process, is life has, you know, finds a way in. And I think it's hopefully to the book's benefit that, that it does both, to the extent that it does. But I think, you know, all my books have sort of walked a line between comedy and drama. And that's just, you know, I personally tend to think I'm kind of a funny person, but I've known for writing these tearjerkers now. I don't know why that keeps happening. You know, those are always the stories that I'm, you know, attracted to and inspired by. I think back to like, you know, a movie like Terms of Endearment, the Larry McMurtry book is very different, but a movie like Terms of Endearment, where everyone remembers it's, you know, Deborah Winger saying goodbye to her kids, and it's really sad, but it's also one of the funniest movies ever made to me. Like, it is, if you go back and watch it now, it is just brimming with the sort of over the top humorous moments. And that's, you know, that those are the kind of, you know, stories that I really respond to, I think. And it's kind of reflective of how life is.
Exactly.
Even in our darkest moments, you know, and I think about, you know, the year like we've all just come through, you know, when we're all feeling really isolated and sometimes and have dark thoughts, we also sometimes they're very darkly humorous as well. And that's kind of what pulls us through.
Sort of, yeah, piggybacking off of that a little bit, the letter Patrick wrote to himself after his partner's death left me pretty raw feeling.
Absolutely.
And it really put us into his mindset in the immediate aftermath of Joe's death, which made his current grief feel like really profound and heartbreaking. And in this exploration of grief throughout the novel showed us that it won't look the same for any two people, even when they're grieving the same loss. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you navigated each of the characters' personal grief and how you use Patrick sort of as a tent pole for all of that?
Yeah, the letter that appears in the book is something that I had drafted early on as almost, I don't want to say a cheat of sorts, because I don't want to undercut its importance to the book. But my first two novels were written in the first person. And so, you know, I was able to access every inner thought, every emotion that was happening in those two lead characters. Where The Gunkle is the first book I wrote in the third person. It's third person close, but it's still third person. And Patrick's been sort of hiding his own grief journey from the kids. But I think he also recognizes, too, that the way that he has handled grief is not really the future that he wants for the kids. And the way to avoid that is for him to sort of lead by example, which means he's got to change his grief journey a bit. And the turning point for that comes when the audience really needs to understand it. So I thought, you know, how can I have something that's sort of emotionally intimate as I would as if I were writing in the first person? And so that letter came to be because we got to really just hear it entirely in Patrick's voice. And I kept thinking I would cut it or it wouldn't make the subsequent draft or that the publisher would tell me it doesn't work or take it out. But draft by draft by draft, it kept staying and even expanding a little bit. And, you know, it's a real sticking point for me today when I read it. Like when I narrated the audiobook, like that's where I got, you know, to the extent that it doesn't, or just going to sound like a terrible person. I made myself choke up a little bit. It was that letter. It was that letter. Like there's a real sort of raw power to it. And I think it allows us to see Patrick both when grief was really raw and fresh, and contrast that with what grief does over time, which just kind of becomes a fabric of who we are. Like we're not crying in a corner, you know, every day, 8 years later, but it's still part of who we are. And so it was a way to sort of compare and contrast that a little bit and then allow him to re-examine about, you know, where he might want to go from there.
I love that. One of the things that I found just kind of just endearing was the throuple next door. They have such profound insights and just unwavering support. And it goes from, you know, sort of a superficial, you know, top layer friendship to something much more deep and meaningful. And I was really struck by Patrick having his found family and his genetic family and the support, especially when, you know, you think about the letter. I'm just curious about what that aspect meant to you, or was it important to have that juxtaposition?
I love that people love the thruple.
They're amazing.
They were so much fun to write. Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the fun things about, you know, setting the story in Palm Springs. I thought, okay, well, it'll be interesting to write against the backdrop of, you know, a story about grief against the backdrop of unrelenting, cheerful sunshine that, you know, the setting wasn't going to match the mood. And then there's a bit of a fish out of water element too for kids, because Palm Springs is a city that many associate with retirement, with sort of the end of life and not sort of raising kids, although people do, but it's not, you know, primarily what the city's known for. And then to have like, okay, well, who are the people they might see and interact with, and how would they be different than their, you know, sort of suburban Connecticut life? And so I thought, oh, you know what? I'm going to put a gay thruple next door, which again is something I thought my publisher would be like, all right, you tone this down. but, you know, I came to really enjoy that. And then the fun of writing them was allowing them to sort of subvert expectation a little bit, like using them to have actual, you know, real wisdom and serious things to contribute to the story when you think they might just be sort of a silly device at first. I really think it's a great joy. You know, people have asked, you know, are you going to write a serial, a sequel or a spinoff or anything like that? And I thought, you know what, the fun part would be to sort of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern this story and then rewrite it again from the thruple's perspective on the other side.
That'd be amazing. Wall.
I would read that.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. They were sort of a true joy to write. And then I love, Jill, that you mentioned found family, because found family is such a it has such a, you know, important history in queer culture because, you know, things have gotten better, obviously, but for a long time, you know, many queer people were cast out of their birth families and found families became, you know, sort of the true new meaning of family. So, you know, to the extent that Patrick has his little found family in Palm Springs, or that Patrick and the kids, even though there's a blood relation, that they're still sort of thrust together in this sort of new family dynamic was interesting to explore. You know, as well as threes, you know, Patrick and the two kids, they make up a tight threesome. Patrick and Clara and Greg, his brother and sister, they're a three, a threesome, the throuple in threes. And the interesting thing I find about that is sometimes you're all in alignment, but often if there's disagreement, it's two against one. And it's not always the same two against one, you know, on different issues or different realignments. And so threes are something that was, you know, just always very interesting to think about in terms of relationships. I don't know that a throuple would work for me, but I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by it.
I know that it wouldn't for me.
Oh no, Michael, why?
I have a complex and am very codependent on my husband. It's not healthy. I admit that fully.
But sometimes I'm like, you know what? If I could just like, you know, you guys spend tonight, I'm just going to go to the guest room tonight and spend, you know, I just have a night by myself. Like then I'm like, oh, maybe I see the appeal.
Reading it, I certainly saw the appeal for sure.
Yeah,
you mentioned Patrick's brother and sister, and I just loved reading those passages, especially with the sister, because it was so hard to read. And I think that, you know, family dynamics in adulthood are weird and complicated, and there's a ton of baggage there. And I as hard as it was to read emotionally, I have to imagine that was kind of difficult to write.
Yeah, but I love sibling relationships. I love stories about siblings, adult siblings, particularly because I think there's always so much history there. And I'm fascinated also by the ways in which we can grow up in the same families and be completely different people. And the idea of sort of what is genetic and what is not, you know, and that all that comes to play in sort of sibling relationships and dynamics. I'm the oldest of four kids myself, and two boys and two girls. So, you know, and these are profoundly important relationships to me. And I just love to read about. What did I read recently? Oh, the most fun we ever had, Claire Lombardo, about three adult sisters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I love stories like that. I love books about adult siblings because there's so much drama to explore. But yeah, you know, Patrick's very different from his brother and sister, and you know, but they all have valid viewpoints. Even Clara, who goes about things not how I would go about them, certainly, but she has a point of view, and she's not wrong about some things. You know, there are ways in which I wish Patrick behaved better with the kids, but I just would have to pull Clara inside and say, well, novels about perfect people who behave perfectly all the time are not all that interesting.
Right.
So sorry, Claire, I'm going to give you some reasons to be upset. But yeah, they're all very, very interesting to me. I do like how Patrick said, you know, that she views him as kind of a frivolous, very self-centered person. And there's a line in the book somewhere where, you know, I believe particularly for gay men of my age, and I just turned 50, so I came out in the very early 1990s, that sort of radical self-love was didn't make you self-centered in a way. It was a way to survive when the entire world was telling you that something was wrong with you, and you know in your heart that it isn't wrong, that it, in fact, it's so very right, you know, that you're being this truthful and honest about who you are, that loving yourself can, you know, can be a way to survive. And so, that certainly plays out in the Clara Patrick dynamic.
Yeah. We talk about that all the time, how, self-love isn't selfish. It's self-preservation, especially for queer people.
Yes.
I'm wondering if we can talk for a minute about Sarah.
No.
Oh my gosh. Or like just the rest of the time talking about Sarah.
I know. Yeah. Her life is felt throughout the novel, and I really loved the multitude that she was. You see her as a friend, as a wife, as a mom, as a college student, kind of all the parts that make her who she was. And they're all valued. And I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with this conversation, but here's what I said to Michael earlier. Yes, I am a mom and I have 4 kids. And that does comprise 85% of what goes on in my brain and what I do with my time. Yeah. But it's also not who I am. But I am. Anyway.
Yeah. Right.
I'm just curious. I just felt like that was so captured in Sarah. And I'm just curious about how she came about and how you were able to weave that complexity into her.
Yeah, I think, Sarah became a larger part of the book, as I mentioned, you know, as I lost my own friend and she couldn't help but be inspired by the friend that I lost. But I think the kids are attracted to Patrick in a way because he has pieces of their mother's biography that they don't know. And I think, you know, I said this, now the books are blurring together, but it's in one of my books, I said, I think that, you know, children are often guilty of thinking their parents are born on the same day that they were as fully functioning adults, that all of our stories began together and that parents don't have childhoods of their own or past or heartbreaks or, you know, are screwed up by something that happened, you know. At some point along the way that has nothing to do with them being a parent or their relationship with their children. And so certainly Patrick has access to bits of Sarah's biography that the children don't know. And I think they find that fascinating. Particularly for them, you know, as tragically the mother that they had is now a finite resource. You know, she's not around to ask her about these things and to learn more in the future. Or to see what her future self will be. It's now the past self becomes so much more important. So I think that's why she looms so large over the book. For Patrick, you know, I sort of love his sort of selfish interpretation of, will people understand what it means to lose a parent? People understand what it means to lose a wife or a husband, but, you know, losing a friend is a less sort of quantifiable thing because we have all kinds of friends for all kinds of purposes. And some are very close and some are acquaintances. Also, you know, there's no deal with friends. Particularly in midlife where sort of I am now, I have friends who are 20 years older. I have friends who are 20 years younger. And there, you know, and that you can lose friends at different stages in your life. And so the idea about sort of grieving friends is I think something that we haven't explored enough because sometimes they can leave a bigger hole in our lives than even a familial relationship for some people. So it was really interesting to write about, and I just love the idea of Sarah as such a warm and lovely person and just that sort of her energy hovering around this story. And sometimes that takes, you know, a physical manifestation in a flashback. And sometimes it's just the idea of her hanging over everything they do.
Yeah. And it was so touching every time that he would say to one of the kids how he saw their mother in them in that way. Yeah. She just resonated, whether or not it was about her in the moment. She was there always.
She was there. Yeah.
I don't know how to ask this. Was there ever a draft where the book started with her still alive?
Yes. When I originally opened the book, it was with Patrick and Sarah together.
Oh, wow.
And I felt like instinctually like we needed her at the start of the story. And that got rewritten then to Patrick telling the kids about the story and sort of like a flash forward. And then we flash back to to her death a little bit. But yeah, I knew like she was so important that the story had to kind of begin with her. And it just, as I said, it took on a different manifestation now. But yeah, how interesting that you sort of sussed that out.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about subverting expectations, and something that I loved about the experience reading this book was how it really took me to task with my own set of expectations. And at a certain point, I thought I had an idea. I had an expectation of how the Gonkul was going to end. And I thought sort of in broad terms, like, okay, this might end with Patrick choosing his family and it will be last minute and maybe in an airport. And I, like very You've Got Mail. Mm-hmm. And I was mm-hmm. fine with that. And I realized by the end was that I was unconsciously changing whose story this was. And at the end of the day, this is Patrick's story. And sure, other people's stories are funneled through him, but it's his story.
Right.
And so when his brother leaves the rehab facility and they do go to the airport, there was still like a lot of book left. And I was like, oh, okay. So I was wrong. But I just loved it. In the end, it wasn't one thing or the other. It was both and kind of everything, but finally on his terms. And I guess I just want to ask you about the balance about that. Like, how did the ending change over time? How did you strike that balance of what he wants in his career and moving forward out of his grief? And ultimately, yes, he wants more time with his family. And did any of these aspects like threaten to take over? Like, did you have to hold back at all?
Yeah, I think, you know, and so maybe I should just start by saying, you know, these stories have been told before. You know, there's the unprepared caregiver sort of being forced to step up. You know, there's a very famous example in a book in Raising Helen, and there's everything from, you know, as I said, Auntie Mame to Mary Poppins to Maria and the Sound of Music. You know, it's not a new genre, but it was like quite an honor to put an LGBTQ plus spin yes. on, you know, or make a queer entry into the genre. I, you know, that in terms of crafting an ending, I thought very much about, okay, well, who is this? And one of the joys in being gay for me, particularly coming at a time when it was long before gay marriage, it was long before same-sex couples were having kids at the rate that they are today, it sort of freed me from societal expectations of what my life should be. And I was allowed to then just choose what I want. There was no expectation then that I would get married because same-sex marriage wasn't even a thing, you know, in the 1990s. There was no expectation that I should want children. I had to stop and think. I had the luxury of thinking, do I want children? To bring the story in for a landing, you know, I really sort of went back to that idea in terms of like, what would Patrick want for his life? What is he choosing? What is he, what is important to sacrifice of himself? And what is important for him to continue to be a slightly selfish character? And I don't even mean that in the worst sense of the word. I mean, to continue to sort of be an example for Maisie and Grant by saying, no, you can have a complete life. Like, these things can be out there. Dreams can still come true for you, you know, even though you've suffered this sort of very debilitating loss. So, you know, all that sort of went into my thinking in terms of the ending. And for Patrick, not just what is like, you know, it's not just him getting back to life. It's not him stepping back into an old life. It is him stepping forward into a new life that maybe gives him the best of what he got from the old life, and then plus, you know, sort of all the joys of what he has acquired since.
I loved him.
I love him too. I mean, it means so much because he's, you know, he can be a bit much sometimes, but, you know, to the extent that people have said online that, oh, I love Patrick, I wish Patrick were my best friend, or I want to be Michael Gonkul, there is part of me, and I'm not losing touch with reality, I swear, but there is like for half a second, I want to pick up the phone and call Patrick and tell him how loved he is. And, yeah. You know, there's part of me that wishes I could do that, but alas.
Speaking of bringing Patrick to life, when I reached out to your publisher to see if we could schedule this interview, in addition to gushing about the book, I mentioned that in our Instagram DMs for the podcast, a couple other readers that enjoyed the book and I were casting the film adaptation that we were dreaming
of.
Tell
me what you got.
And now I hear it's going to happen.
It is in the works. It is being planned. With Hollywood, you don't like to count chickens necessarily, but I am recording this on a break from actually writing the screenplay, which I'm doing right now.
Oh, no way.
And I'm very excited about that. I'm fortunate. I'm incredibly fortunate to have all three of my books in various stages of development for film, and so I did write the adaptation for the editor also, which is moving forward. I did not write the adaptation for Lily and the Octopus. I take these sort of as very individual decisions each time, whether or not I can be the right person to to bring it to the screen, because it's an incredibly different, it's a different
medium. Yeah.
Medium. It requires different things from a writer. In this case, I felt, so close to Patrick. I was like, I didn't want to hand him off to anybody else to do this. And I was fortunate to find a partner in Lionsgate Studios who believed in me and my ability as well. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you. The fun part truly is imagining the casting. And then again, this will be hopefully a big, in theater, sort of family comedy. And there are two genres, particularly, that I always think are, benefit from having an audience, a communal experience. I miss live performance. I miss concerts. I miss going to movies.
Yes.
And, to me, that's horror. And it's also comedy. And those things are things that I think always benefit from watching with an audience. So I hope one day in the not too distant future to be, we can all gather and watch this in the on a big screen.
I'm just so happy for you. I was just so, I don't want to sound ridiculous, but I was just so moved by the Gunkle, and even down to I was reading your acknowledgments and getting weepy, and even down to your husband answering your husband's proposal. I was just full blubbers and texting Jill about it. And I really do think it's a perfect blend of comedy and genuine emotion, that dramedy is the only genre that is capable of doing that. And I just loved reading it so much, and I cannot wait to see it.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, let's circle back to sort of, your casting ideas. I would love to hear that. But two, the acknowledgments is that, first of all, I always read acknowledgments in books.
Yeah.
I don't know if you both do, but I always learn so much, either about a piece of research or the writing process, or, there's always some little nugget in there that I find fascinating. And certainly for me, that started last summer with my now husband's debut novel. His name is Byron Lane. He wrote a book called The Star is Bored.
It's a beautiful cover.
Which, you guys love covers. Yeah,
yes.
Great cover. which he was for years Carrie Fisher's personal assistant. And so the novel is sort of inspired by
their friendship. Your husband was actually Carrie Fisher's personal assistant?
Yeah, he was working for Carrie Fisher when we met, when we started dating. And so she loomed large over the first couple years of our relationship.
We just did an episode about, I can't remember what the episode was about, but I recommended Postcards from the Edge.
Yes.
This is one of my favorite books.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't read A Star is Bored, certainly there's a character based on Carrie, and there's a character based on Debbie Reynolds as well. So it's a little, it's a little bit, I hate to call it, I would never presume to call it a sequel to, Postcards from the Edge. But if you love Postcards from the Edge, you will love this book as well.
Oh, okay,
and anyhow, so at the end of his book, he proposed in the acknowledgments, and I did not know this was coming, and because we're two writers living in the same house. We pass drafts back and forth to each other. We're each other's first reader. I thought I knew that book backwards and forwards. And then the hardcover arrives last July on our doorsteps for the first time. And he hands it to me. And he's like, look at the acknowledgments again. Oh. And he had added, four words at the end. Will you marry me? And, I was just sort of stunned, because I was like, wait, is this in all the copy? And it is. You can get it and read it and whatnot. And so, I've spoiled it now on this podcast, but we to the extent that you want to read my answer to his proposal, it is at the back of acknowledgments for the Gunkle.
Yeah, it was like a prequel. Like, I read your book and I couldn't believe it. So I ran to the library. I'm speaking hyperbolically. The next day I went to the library and found his book and read the acknowledgments. It is truly in my TBR pile right now. But I read his acknowledgments at least. It was fun to read backwards.
Yay. That's so funny. So that was very sweet. That was very sweet moment for us. And now it's all documented in the Library of Congress.
Goals.
I feel like it doesn't get more official than that for book people.
Truly. It was very, very romantic. No, I wanted to know if there was someone you absolutely saw as Patrick or as someone from the book for the movie version, because I always love hearing these.
Okay, I'm really struggling with this one. Like we were talking about this, and who did the person on Instagram say, Zachary Quinto?
That's what I said.
Oh
yeah, yeah.
He'd be
great because he has that slightly bristly quality, but you know, it's probably a heart of gold under there. I've a lot of Schitt's Creek fans, a lot of people.
You said too.
Yeah, that was my other suggestion, was Jan Levy.
And then I've heard Andrew Rannells and Neil Patrick Harris.
Oh, you know, he would be pretty great. Awesome. I mean, a little young, but he'd be great.
Yeah, I do. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please, you.
I was going to say, I'm not sure that I have a hard and fast rule in every single case that an out actor should play, you know, a queer role.
Sure.
I do think that's ideal. But anyway, in this case in particular, I do think it's essential. I really do. You know, to the extent that Patrick has any superpowers as a caregiver, it all comes from his lived experience as an out gay person, you know, his empathy, his worldview, his politics, his sense of self, his sense of humor, his pop cultural references, they all stem from, you know, everything he's throwing at these kids stems from his lived experience as a gay man. So I do think in this case, it's particularly important.
Agreed.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh, this has been such a joy. I cannot believe we were able to do this. Stephen Rowley, thank you so much for being here. You can buy any of Stephen's books, Lily and the Octopus, The Editor, and The Gunkle, as we've talked about today, from our bookshop affiliate link. You can find Stephen on Instagram at Mr. Stephen Rowley. And that's it, I think.
What else is there? Buy books and go on Instagram. What else is there? Yeah.
Yes. And then try and write a book, but you have to get off Instagram to do it.
Yes.
Listen,
I recommend reading at least on the first day while wearing a caftan.
Oh, 100%.
Oh, for sure. The caftans, you know, has been so fun. You know, I threw them in the book and suddenly, like, you know, I am known as Mr. Caftan all of a sudden. So
yes.
I did do a tour, a video tour of my caftan closet. Look for that. That'll be dropping on Instagram soon.
We'll link to it.
Some other fun things, you know, giveaways and discounts. And
fine. Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real joy.
How delightful is Stephen Rowley?
Like, it's almost illegal. He is the most delightful. And again, as I always say, even like, I thought I knew how much I loved this book.
Mm-hmm.
And then after talking to him, I'm just like, cool, this is easily one of the top five books I've read this year.
Yes.
I love talking to him about it. I loved the ways that he sort of, not explicitly, but implicitly used aspects of what he's gone through in life to help guide the characters on their own journeys. I thought it was just a beautiful conversation with a really delightful man.
I agree. I don't know why I'm surprised. Every time we talk to an author, I'm like, I love this book even more now than I did before. So you would think like I would just know that, but somehow I don't learn. It was just so fun. I loved the book before. As you say, I love it more now. I want to be in real life friends.
Yeah.
If he finds me in his Palm Springs swimming pool, having brought my own giant float with me, he has no one to blame but himself. He was charming.
Yeah. It's less of an if and more of a when.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I got to do some caftan shopping and then I'm there.
Yeah. What's the alternative? That we talk to someone and we're just like, well, I hate this book now.
I can't really see that happening, but I guess it could.
Yeah, thank God that hasn't happened.
Seriously, I don't even want to like put that thought into the universe.
What I loved about talking to Stephen was how he is separate from the fictional story he told.
Mm-hmm.
His sense of humor, however, shines through.
Yes.
And I just loved that he was just as witty and clever as Patrick was in the story, but also like individual people. Like, he is not Patrick, but aspects of who he is have found their way into Patrick's personality.
Yes. And I can say now I have finished second of his books.
Oh, yeah.
I finished The Editor yesterday, and I feel like it comes through in that book.
Okay.
In a similar but different way, where it's a story of real substance, but that witty humor is there. Yes. And I don't know, it's just an amazing talent.
Something else that's, I think, really an amazing talent is a person's ability to balance humor and raw emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And it not feel like an imbalance. I mean, I think that people, I've talked about this before, I think people have a hard time being satisfied with what is a dramedy because they want something that is either strictly comedy or just really sad.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they read or watch or listen, or read or watch something that is a little bit of both, it's like, well, where do I put this in my head? Like, what is this? And mm-hmm. it's like, well, it's life. Like, it's a dramedy.
Especially when it's doing it well.
So well.
Yeah, I agree.
Totally.
So if our listeners missed our build up to this interview and some of the discussion we've been having online over the last few weeks, like, what's the best way for them to like jump in?
Absolutely. Head to our bookshop affiliate link, bookshop.org/shop/bookapod, and buy your copy of The Gunkle by Stephen Rowley or any of the other book club picks we've done this year. Then if you go into our Instagram at bookapod, you will see over the course of the last couple of months, we've been talking about The Gunkle, and we've asked very specific book club questions about The Gunkle that led up to the previous episode, which was just Jill and myself talking about the book. So now you've listened to this episode. If you go to our website at bookapod.com, you will find a ton of book club questions that if you are a member of a book club yourself and you want to bring this to a discussion, bring our questions with you and fill us in. Let us know how that went, what you think of the book. Tell us if you disagree with us or agree with us, or if you loved it or thought it was just okay. We have an email at info@bookapod.com. We'd love to hear from you.
So fun.
And also, just a reminder, so this is the last book club of season two. I have loved doing this. I think that it is so fun to read a book at the same time as Jill and get to talk about it with her and then talk about it with you guys and then talk about it with the author. In season three, we're going to continue book club. It's going to look a little bit different. We've talked about this previously. We're going to not necessarily do front list. I think that, you know, something that we've missed is talking about backlist books because they deserve some love too. And we want to use that as an opportunity to remember, hey, I didn't get to read this book when it came out. Let's do a book club chat about it. And I really can't wait because there's my TBR pile is like in two piles. One is front list and one is all of the backlist books that I haven't gotten to yet.
Yes. And when we're done recording today, I have an idea of like one I want to ask you about already for next season.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I cannot wait.
I know.
Like a book you want to talk about?
Yeah. And an author that I want to, that I think it'd be fun for us to talk to.
Have I read the book?
I don't think so. I think it's in your TBR.
Well, I'm swimming in a pile of TBR, so that could absolutely be any.
I could say that about anything. Yeah. No, I'm really excited for kind of an organic approach, and I'm interested to see also what people are reading and responding to and kind of make our choices more on the fly isn't the right really word.
No, but I know what you mean, though.
It's not quite so far in advance, and
And it's exactly like something that we haven't really been able to explore, which is totally fine. It has been in those moments where you and I are just reading sort of independently and you let me, you're like, I just read this book. I loved it. And then that's sort of separate from like what we're doing here. And now it's kind of like we can marry those two things.
Absolutely.
If you happen to be reading a book you love, you can be like, I think this would be a really great book club title if you want to read it. And then let's decide. I love that that's where we're headed with this.
Yay.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you, Stephen Rowley. Thank you,
Stephen Rowley's publisher.
This was delightful. I've already listed everywhere you can find us. Otherwise, leave us alone. It is the end of the year. We're exhausted. Love you. Mean it.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
Book It is available across podcast platforms.
Subscribe to never miss an episode, and don't forget to leave a review before you go.
We'd love to stay in touch. You can find us online at bookitpod.com or on Instagram and Twitter at bookitpod.
Want to read something you heard on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/BookitPod.
Book It was created by hosts Jill Burkett-Ragacy and Michael Woodson, with sound design and production by Madeline Call at Honeysuckler.